Welcome, everyone, to the first actual episode of Engineer Your Career. On this episode, we talk to James Buckingham, a facade structural engineer with Permastalisa North America, a curtain wall contracting engineering firm in Minneapolis, Minnesota. James received his bachelor's degree in civil engineering from Michigan Technological University in 2010 and a master's degree in civil engineering from the University of South Florida in 2011. He previously worked for the University of South Florida and at the Florida Department of Transportation. Since starting at Permastalisa in January of 2015, James has worked as a staff structural engineer on several projects throughout North America, including high-rise buildings in Colorado, California, Ontario, and Washington. Notably, he was the lead structural engineer on 1144 15th Street, a 44-story office tower in downtown Denver. In our conversation with James, we talked about the technical aspects of facade engineering and heard a great example of how sometimes your career path can take an unexpected detour. Welcome to EYC. James, let's start with how you got to where you are today.
Sure. Well, I went to Michigan Tech to get a civil engineering degree with a concentration in structural engineering. While I was at Tech, I actually became close friends with a student who was like 3 years older than me, who happened to be working for a facade contractor, Permastalisa, who I currently work for. We were kind of friends at school and got to know each other pretty well socially, and he went to work for Permastalisa when he graduated. And so he encouraged me to like apply during my time for internships, but also for full time. So every career fair, I kind of went to Permastalisa's booth and talked to them, try to really pursue working for them. So I really wanted to work in the curtain wall industry and the architectural field as an engineer. It was something that really piqued my interest. So I did, and I pursued them hard. Unfortunately, nothing ever came of an internship, but I did have that contact with my colleague from school, who happens to also still work at Permastalisa alongside with me. But job did not turn up. I went to graduate school and got a master's in civil engineering. And I did that down at the University of South Florida in Florida and stayed in Florida and worked for the Florida Department of Transportation for a couple years before my colleague Don reached out to me and said that Permastalisa was hiring. They were looking for structural engineers and asked if I was still interested. And I was. And so I took the leap and I ended up interviewing and moving to Minnesota from Florida to pursue a structural engineering position with Permastalisa.
Did you know before your friend that you wanted to be a structural engineer? Or how, I guess, was it really just the main influence of that person that drove you to be a structural engineer?
Yeah. So actually going into college, I wanted to work in water resources. I specifically chose civil engineering because I wanted to help people. I knew I loved math and science in middle school and high school and elementary school. So I knew I wanted to do some form of engineering. I chose civil because it seemed the most applicable to helping daily lives for people, especially water resources, with drinking water and potable water. So I originally went in thinking I wanted to kind of go that route, like third world water development. But once I got to school, I fell in love with my mechanics and materials classes and my statics classes and structural engineering one and structural analysis one that basically changed gears, where I took all of my concentration courses in structures, so steel, reinforced concrete. Although I did pursue my master's degree is in water resources engineering in the developing world, so I kind of still dabbled in that before choosing structural engineering as a concentration.
So I'm going to have you step back just a second here. So you said you're working for Permastalisa in kind of facade engineering. Can you elaborate a little bit on what that is for some of us, including myself, who has no idea what that type of work is?
Sure. So facades are basically the exterior of a building, whether it's a skyscraper, a campus style building, or even your local kind of like strip malls, like the storefronts that you see. It's the exterior, whether that's glass, metal, masonry, brick. That's all kind of the facade. It's the skin. It's what is like the air and water barrier for the building. Permastalisa, who I work for, we are specifically what's called a custom curtain wall contractor. So there are different types of facades. The one that I specialize is called curtain wall, where basically you have primarily glass or stainless steel panels that get framed in metal. In our case, we use primarily aluminum. And then these are like 5 foot by 10 foot tall panels that get hung onto the concrete slabs. And they basically have like male and female joints that kind of allow the building to move and sway with whether it's an earthquake or with the wind. and acts as that air water billing to keep air out, to keep your HVAC system running so that you have, you don't have thermal gains or thermal losses. And it's structural in nature because we want to stay onto the building and protect the public who are inside the building, while also not carrying the structural load of the building itself. It's all kind of like an independent system that the building carries.
Oh, that's interesting, James. So it sounds really complex. It sounds like there's a lot of things to consider. I guess, how can you, I mean, you've probably moved on from the entry level position, but can you tell me like what's the title of that position? And then like, what is that person doing every day? Like the entry level engineer working on curtain wall?
Sure. So my current title is a structural engineer one, which in my case, or specifically for PermaSlisa, the company I work for, that means kind of two general roles. It means I'm a lead engineer, and I'll kind of go into that. And then, but it also means I'm a PE, I'm a professional engineer who is science stamping and legally responsible for the job and the project. So as a lead engineer, mainly what that means is I'm responsible for the submittal package. A submittal package is a collection of drawings and the supporting calculations that show that the drawings, one, are constructible, two, can be built, and that three are like are safe and meet all the codes and standards dictated by the governing agencies. So as the lead engineer, I'm reviewing the drawings that our design team is developing. I'm working hand in hand with the designers to come up with the design of what the vertical framing members look like, what the horizontal framing members look like, how the connections, how does one vertical member and one horizontal member get connected? So with that is I'm working with them to come up with a plan, but then I'm also doing the math. I'm doing a lot of equations, looking at different types of beam equations and end connection equations to design those fasteners. So it's very calculation heavy as a lead engineer. But then additionally, I have junior engineers who will work underneath me, who I will dictate workload, tasks, and kind of set the schedule and the plan for them. Additionally, I'll work hand in hand with our HVAC engineers who are working on heat gain and heat loss through our system, as well as working with like our product design manager who kind of sets the overall project schedule and the overall budget on how we're doing as an engineering team on this project. So as a lead, my primary goal is I'm responsible for the calculations, but I'm also responsible with working with all the other members of the team that are designing the other aspects of the facade. As the PE, my role is to review all the calculations. So whether it's a calculation that I do or it's a calculation that any of the junior engineers do, I'm reviewing those to make sure that they are structurally adequate and accurate for the job. So I'm also, along with reviewing the calculations, I'm also reviewing the drawings, right? And I'm signing and stamping them, saying that these have been designed according to the most recent code set, that they meet the standard of whatever state I'm working in and I'm licensed in, and that this can be built and is going to protect the general public.
Okay. So when you started then, I forget, how long did you say you've been working at PermaSlisa now?
I've been with PermaSlisa for 5 years.
5 years. So when you started, did you come in as kind of one of those junior roles, or were you able to jump right into this role?
Yeah, no. So I started as a junior engineer. So as a junior engineer, I was very calculation heavy. I'd say on a typical 8-hour day, I was spending, 7 to 7.5 hours of that day doing calculations, running the numbers, applying some of that engineering, the math and the equation sets that you learn in school to the project. Yeah.
And is this predominantly like we think like statics class, like engineering paper equations, or is this you in a software package?
Yeah. So a little bit of both. So predominantly it's, we use a software called MathCAD, which is basically a word processor for math equations. So most of it is typing out equation sets in MathCAD and doing the calculations, what we say by hand, but is really like using the computer to do it, just like you would in school on engineering pad. But there is a lot of modeling and using the computer to help too. So we built a lot of frame models, which is just kind of representing the beams and the columns of the facade system. and then also doing some finite element modeling when we have like an intricate connection or an intricate detail that requires more analysis than a simple frame. We would do some of that modeling as well. So it's kind of both hand calculations and computer modeling.
Got it. So how long did you feel like when you started doing this with frame, like coming in as a junior engineer who was working in another area besides structural, how long did it take you to really get comfortable with doing that, to kind of making a switch into this, even though that was what you wanted to do and what you had focused on in college for parts of it? What was kind of the learning curve like ramping up into that position?
Yeah, so it's a steep learning curve, and I didn't really feel comfortable until a good 9 months in was the first time I started to feel comfortable doing, I would say, like the general design work, like the typical design work that we do. But I encounter new experiences and new engineering challenges and new design ideas on a daily basis, to where like we're always kind of learning and growing. But it definitely took a while. So specifically with facade design, we're dealing with glass, we're dealing with aluminum, with stainless steel. These are three main materials, additionally with silicone. So the four primary materials we use, I never learned about in school. Okay. Aluminum is similar to steel. And so there's some like knowledge that we can apply that what I learned in steel class to aluminum. And so like you kind of rely on that knowledge. But a lot of it is learning all new material types, all new material behaviors, and then how you kind of apply the equations that you've learned to those types of materials. But yeah, but the thing that I've kind of reflected on the most is that like sophomore year of engineering school, when I took mechanics of materials, when I took statics, intro to dynamics and things, those classes are what I rely on a daily basis. It's applying that fundamental engineering knowledge to the problems I encounter.
That's really interesting, James. I think what's interesting to me is it seems very different than my experience in that, you know, I feel like I rarely use some of those equations. But I guess, do you feel like during your time, like in undergrad or grad school, was there a time that you felt like you could accurately describe the position you're in today? What I mean by that is, you know, if someone said, hey, you're going to be a structural engineer out in industry, do you feel like you could have accurately described what the day-to-day would be like while you were in undergrad or in grad school?
I don't think so. What I thought of college as an engineer does is a lot of like calculation heavy work, right? Like here's a clearly defined problem, and I'm just going to solve it and kick out the answer. Kind of like what we had for homework sets, right? I think what you learn, or what I've learned in the facade industry and as a structural engineer for the last 5 years, is that one, a clearly defined problem is a gift and doesn't always happen. And we kind of have to learn how to make some assumptions and simplifications to turn a problem into something that can be clearly defined and solved for, would be one. And then two is that lots of times I'm working with other people, right? And the design decisions, it's one thing for me to have a problem and then just create a solution and hand it over to my drafter and say, you know, draft this. There are times that happens. But many times a decision I make as an engineer directly impacts my designer, who's making sure that the facade is waterproof, right? So a good example of this is I will lots of times change our vertical framing members for us specifically are custom, right? So on an early job, I will dictate the wall thicknesses, the flange thicknesses of the vertical framing member, which if you think about it, is basically like a channel made out of aluminum. And I dictate all the thicknesses of those walls. For me, it might be really easy to say, I need this wall to go from an eighth inch thick to like 0.15 inches to get it to work structurally for the wind load. However, on my current job, when I said that, the mechanical engineer who was looking at the thermal performance of the wall came back and said, we can't do that, right? There ends up being too much condensation risk with the thicker wall type. So we end up having to come up with different options and different solutions. Like my engineering decisions have a big impact on other fields than just myself and other team members who are helping design the system. And I don't think I ever really imagined that in school. I thought it was, I work independently and kick out the problem. I didn't realize there was this much collaboration, the design team as a whole.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a common theme that a lot of people run into when we go from being like forced into groups in college projects that we're like, no way, this is real. And doing our homework like by ourselves to all of a sudden, like you're in a group of, you know, 5 to 10 plus people all trying to solve a common problem. So yeah, I think that is a really good observation. I think we're all running into when we leave university and head out in the real world. So stepping away from what you're doing now, when you left college, you said like you weren't able to get a job at Permastalisa. And so you kind of took a roundabout way to get there. Tell us a little bit about kind of what, if any, plan you had when you left college, weren't able to get that job and kind of pursued other opportunities.
Sure. Yeah. So as part of my senior design in college, I had the opportunity to do a travel abroad one where I went to Bolivia to work on a canalization project for a seasonal river near a school down there. And by traveling abroad and being able to work on that and meet kind of the local people who are impacted like by that design and that project that we ended up presenting to them at the end of the semester, it was just really impactful. And I felt just like kind of this call to, again, like to use engineering to better the world and to better people, better society. And so I had the opportunity after that trip. I actually did that trip with the University of South Florida. It was kind of a joint trip between Michigan Tech and USF. And I had the opportunity to pursue my master's work, continuing in that development theme by conducting some research on some hand pumps in Bolivia. And it was a great experience, something that I really felt a calling for, like a really excitement about at the time. So I was able to do that, to travel to Bolivia and like do some field research on testing the sustainability of these hand pumps. It wasn't my specific research. It was a PhD student that I was collaborating with and helping him conduct his research. But it was a great experience to be able to work on that.
So that was largely an experience driven your last probably senior design one semester or two semesters?
For ours, it was one semester, and it was the last semester before I graduated. Yeah, so it was a very like quick change towards the end of my undergraduate career.
Yeah, because so prior to January of that year, you were thinking you were going to go into civil engineering job somewhere in the States?
Yeah, that is correct. Yep.
Or structural engineering job. That's interesting. It's amazing how like just those experiences. Well, and it's also circumstances too, right? It sounds like you had applied to other jobs and, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work out, but it sounds like you had this good experience and that drove you into grad school. So it sounds like how you got into that institution in South Florida. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I had other job offers with other companies coming out of school that I, you know, declined to pursue the graduate school because I did kind of fall in love with that experience and thought I wanted to pursue that further. So they just wasn't necessarily with Permastalisa, who again like kind of is kind of my, I don't want to say dream company, but like working in the facade industry was definitely a goal or dream of mine that I was able to do eventually.
That's funny. I don't imagine there's like any kid when he's growing up to be like, I really want to work on facades when I grow up. But then how everything changes once you get older, you learn more, you find like these specific details of things you want to work on and how that like can be really exciting in different ways. And hearing that for you and like facade, I think that's really cool to be like, here's something I mean, did you know about facades at all before? I mean, you heard about it in university?
Yeah, no, not at all. Right. It was like my sophomore year at the career fair, you know, running into my friend, who like my current coworker who I knew when I was a freshman, like I ran into him, he was working for the company. And that's kind of like when I first heard about it. Right. But all of a sudden, like you see someone else's passion, you kind of see, for me, it was like seeing the skyscraper, seeing these monumental buildings that are being built, the way that skylines get changed. And I kind of, it got me, I kind of lit up with excitement, right? The idea that I can, I can have an impact in changing the skyline. I think as a young engineer, kind of being math and science focused, I grew up always kind of seeing, like especially sports stadiums were always big for me, how like you kind of get this attachment to a sports stadium and the way it looks, and being able to kind of do that now as a professional is very cool.
Yeah. What's the biggest project or the tallest building that you worked on?
Yeah. So I recently completed about 2 years ago, we had a 43 story tower in downtown Denver, 1144 15th Street, that I was the lead engineer on for that project. And so one really cool thing about working for a contractor and for myself experiencing that project in Denver was you get to be on it from the start to the finish. So we are a design build firm, which is slightly different to where we get brought on in the early stages of the architect coming up with their design plans. And so we aid in that initial design all the way till we are designing it, we're fabricating it and assembling the unitized curtain wall to installing it and constructing it on site. So I was able to kind of be early in on the conversations with the architect, kind of live through the design process, aid the factory in assembling the units and answering questions, and then also being able to visit the field and solving kind of some of those field issues and kind of seeing this project go from day one, you know, to day. It ended up being like 2 years later before the project was actually complete, but seeing this concept become a reality and living through that whole process is quite an amazing experience. It's something that is honestly motivating, because now when I go to downtown Denver, I see the skyline and I can see our building, which is very cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's really cool. I guess with what you just said there, James, I want to kind of reiterate what I heard. So I think there's this process of architect makes the idea, the engineer kind of makes the idea buildable, and then you have the boots on the ground who actually construct it. Roughly, am I there?
Yeah, I think that's a similar, like that's a good high level analysis.
Yeah. Okay. Can you help me understand? I think this is, I assume this is maybe confused between some people, like the difference between an architect and an engineer. And maybe if to what you know, like the difference in education requirements between those two titles?
Yeah, so that's a good question that I don't know entirely of. I know, so the architects do have their own licensing process, so they do have professional development hours similar to us. They follow the same design codes and design standards that a lot of the engineers do. Like they're familiar with the IBC, the International Building Code, and with ACI and ASCE. And so they're designing with those in mind, right? But ultimately, they're trying to push the boundary and come up with something new and creative. So they're considering engineering concepts initially, but then as an engineer, I step in after they have those kind of drawn out and help guide more technically sound design. So what do we actually need to get it in? They will do like rough shapes, rough channels, rough sizes of the members, and I will come in and nail down exactly like what the flange thickness has to be, how much silicone. When the glass is held to the aluminum frame, how much silicone do we actually need to do that? Whereas the architect would just kind of draw in that there is silicone.
Do you ever have to tell the architect that like you can't do what they have designed?
Yes, that has happened before. Not always a fun conversation, right? Because my goal is to make the architect's vision a reality. That's what I want to do. But sometimes that's not possible based on engineering. But we will do whatever we can, whether that's doing more advanced modeling or even doing some testing to make those things happen, like actually designing some testing experiments in lab.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, but I have had to tell an engineer, an architect before that, no, that's not buildable. But as an engineer, one thing I've learned through experience is you never just want to say no without providing alternative solutions, right? So it's like, no, we can't do this, but if we make this minor change, we can have this outcome or this minor change and have this outcome. That way you're kind of still working collaboratively as a team, right?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, James. In my experience with interacting with people, it's always the best to because it helps just show that you just didn't look at it and you don't care, right? I think if you respond back to a, hey, I can't do this with a, hey, here's what I can do. I think people are way more receptive of that because they realize that you're trying to put in effort. Like you're putting in more than what would be seen as the minimal amount of effort in a situation. And I think people can respect that and appreciate it too, because ultimately we're just, you know, trying to change the skyline in your case. And I'm sure the architect would feel the same way. So I guess to hone in on a little bit of the differences, you talked about the process, this licensing process. For civil engineers, it's called the PE, the professional engineer. Can you walk me through a little bit of that? Like even like you working in Denver, what does that mean for the process? And just kind of help the listeners understand what that means. Because I think it's unique to civil engineers. Well, maybe not unique to civil engineers, but maybe to structural engineers.
Sure. Yeah. So basically in school, I think most of us understand and know that we take the fundamentals of engineering exam, like our last year in school. And then every state's slightly different and every state has different requirements. But for most states, it's somewhere between you need 2 to 5 years of experience to sit and take the professional of engineering exam, which is an 8-hour exam that covers, you actually will select a concentration. So there is a structural engineering concentration that I used. So the first morning part is like an overview of your 4 years of school. And then the 4-hour afternoon part is specifically in your concentration. So for me with structural engineering, with that, you get licensed in whatever state you took the exam in. So for myself, I live in Minnesota. I'm based out of Minneapolis. So I took it in Minnesota. I got licensed in Minnesota. And then you're able, depending on what state, you're able to apply for comedy to be able to be a practicing engineer in other states. Different states have different requirements. So for instance, the state of California requires you to have an additional exam where they have you take a surveying and seismic exam to be a licensed professional engineer and a licensed structural engineer in their state. And different states have different requirements for structural engineering. So I am a professional engineer, and with that professional engineering license, I feel competent and able to work in structural engineering, but I can only do that in certain states where a professional engineer can do structural engineering. There are some states like Illinois and like California and some others where as a structural engineer who say you're designing the actual structure of the building, the slabs, the columns, you know, the primary structure, you actually have to be licensed as a structural engineer, which is a different licensing process than, say, a professional engineer. So I think the key thing to learn, this is kind of a confusing system, and every state has different rules, is that you need to know and you need to do the research on your individual state that you're interested in practicing in. So for Colorado, I was the lead engineer. I was not the PE. So I actually worked under a professional engineer who was licensed in Colorado. And he like oversaw, reviewed all my work. Currently, I'm working on a project in the state of Washington, where I am a licensed professional engineer in Washington. So I'm reviewing all of that work. And for that to work in Washington, all I did was apply for comedy with my Minnesota license, with like a work justification explaining my experience and my knowledge as a structural engineer. To get approval from them and to get licensed by the state.
Gotcha. That's helpful. Sorry. It's kind of a confusing process. It sounds like even when you're in it, but that, I think that helped me understand a little bit more.
Yeah, it is a confusing process, and I don't pretend to be an expert. I definitely focus on learning my specific states that I am interested in practicing in, because those are the states where those are like the laws, the statutes that I'm going to be held accountable to, right? So I don't ever claim to be an expert in this.
But do you do any like international work, or does Permista Lisa do any work, even if you don't do it specifically?
Yeah, so Permista Lisa, we're a global company. We have offices around the world. I have not specifically done any international work. However, because we're global, wherever the market and the industry is hot is kind of where the projects are. So right now, as of 2019, California, specifically San Francisco and kind of the West Coast is exploding with new construction, lots of projects being built. And so some of the buildings that are being built in San Francisco by our company are being designed in Italy or designed in Germany or the Netherlands, in some of our offices around the globe. And I know in the past that some European projects have been designed in the United States and vice versa. That's like one of the benefits of that I've found of working for an international company is that as the market moves and changes, and as Asia becomes a heavy construction industry, or Europe or North America, we're able to be flexible and work on different jobs. So even though I haven't, it is something that is possible.
That's cool. Are you hoping that maybe you'll get to someday?
Well, I would love to. Yeah, for sure. That would be very cool.
Related to that, you can do a structural engineering job, or at least, you know, a curtain wall job from pretty much anywhere. Meaning, I guess, can you talk a little bit about like the geographic requirements of this type of position? Like, are there any? Meaning, can you only do this type of job if you live in North America, Europe?
Yeah. So no, you could basically live to do the work itself. You can live anywhere and do the work. The key is, as long as in the instance of the structural engineering side of this, as long as the professional engineer is licensed in the jurisdiction of the project that where it's being built, then you can work on it. So even though I'm based in Minnesota, if I'm licensed in the region where the work is being done, then I can sign and stamp that. But even as an engineer, if I'm working under the PE in that region, then I can do the work under their supervision, right? So I can be based in Minnesota, be working on a project in Asia, as long as I'm working underneath the supervision of a licensed professional in that country, it'll work and it'll be fine. Now, international laws are a difference, and I don't know enough to speak about those per se, but
interesting.
Yeah. So in terms of facade engineering though, Minneapolis, where I'm based, tends to be a hub. So specifically the North American market, there are curtain wall companies or facade companies kind of in all the major metropolitan regions, but most of the larger contractors who do the design build of facades have an office in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and that's where I'm based.
What other companies besides Permastalisa do this type of work?
Yeah, so there's several facade companies. Specifically, since I work in curtain wall, those are the kind of the competitors that I'm familiar with. So that would be, along with Permastalisa, that would be Enclose, Walter Wolf, Benson, Harmon, and Architectural Glass and Aluminum. Those are the ones that kind of come to mind off the top of my head, but I'm sure there are plenty more out there.
Sure. I think it's just helpful for the listeners to have kind of some other things to research, maybe find something else. Because most of those are still located in the Minneapolis area, or they have hubs there, but they're, you know, they probably have headquarters in other states or countries.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of these companies are based in kind of most of the metropolitan areas, and they have an office in Minnesota. So that's why I'm familiar with them. So, but kind of like purposely said, we have an office in Minnesota and in Connecticut and in Miami and Montreal, right? So we're kind of spread all over the place. And looking for curtain wall companies, like these are specific names, but you know, if you search facade, if you search window wall, glazing, glass, along with structural engineering, you'd find other companies, as well as a lot of these companies are contractors. So you have some companies that are contractor oriented, so the construction side, like Permastalisa is. But you also have some companies that are only on the engineering and design side and aren't affiliated with on the construction at all. So, which are kind of two different experiences from an engineering standpoint in terms of what you're exposed to.
So what do you think when you were like applying to this job and trying to get it, what do you think really helped you? I don't just want to say get the job, but what kind of made you stand out in the organization to get it? Or maybe phrase better, for people who are interested in working for Permastalisa or another similar company, what are the skills and experience that they're looking for when they're hiring someone who would be coming in as a junior engineer who doesn't have a lot of experience already?
Sure. So I think there's a couple of things that I tried to put across, but it also, now that I kind of on the other side and I'm hiring and looking for junior engineers, what I look for. One is interest. I want someone who kind of wants to do the work that we're going to do. I want you to be interested and motivated to come to work every day. So I kind of want to see you want to work in the architectural field in facades. Two is, I would like to see, you know, a strong understanding and baseline of fundamental structural engineering knowledge, right? So how are your statics? Do you understand material properties kind of in general, like ductility and brittleness? you don't necessarily need to be an expert on how to design with steel and concrete, but do you understand kind of like the fun, like the basic foundations of engineering from school? Are you comfortable drawing a free body diagram? Kind of those, like those sophomore and junior level classes that you have. And then I think a big one for facades is we tend to be kind of complex shapes and elements on the building. And so a lot of it is like visualizing objects in 3D in our heads, trying to like design three-dimensional shapes in construction just based off 2D drawings. And so the better three-dimensional skills that you have, the better you're able to visualize what's going on. I think it's a great and useful skill that really that can help you be a more successful engineer in the facade industry. Just because we don't use standard steel shapes. Everything we use is, not everything, but the majority of it is custom made. So you're really kind of thinking about new and creative ideas to solve the problems.
Yeah, and for those who are interested, I'm pretty sure the term you're looking for, James, it's called spatial visualization. There's actually different exams and things you can take that can kind of help you understand if you're good or not so good at spatial visualization. Like, can you take this block, remove this part of the block, turn it over, and then what would it look like, type of thing. Because it's a unique thing that seems not necessarily binary with people, but there's definitely people who are better at spatial visualization than others. And so I think that's maybe an interesting point to note, that that's pretty important for your job.
Yeah. And I would say the last one too, and that we really stress on is communication. You don't necessarily have to be a great communicator in the sense of you don't have to be extremely well polished, or you don't always have to know the perfect terminology to use, but are you able to communicate a complex idea to just kind of straightforward and basically at a basic level to someone so they can understand? It's one thing as an engineer to say, this doesn't work, we have to change it. And lots of times that's not a satisfying answer. Whereas if you can kind of explain the engineering concept at a basic level to someone without an engineering degree, so that that way they can get on board, and you can then help change a new design that eliminates that problem. So I think communication skills are, at least for us, and the amount of collaboration that I do on a daily basis is really important.
So related to education then, it sounds like for the most part, just an undergraduate degree in civil engineering would be satisfactory to do what you do. Is that correct?
Yep. So all that we require is an undergraduate degree. Yep.
Okay. But if you wanted to go to grad school, you would want to focus. Is there a structural focus in grad school? Or I guess, what is that called?
Yeah. So you can get a master's in structural engineering. It's very rare for them to be kind of in the facade realm. Most of them are in concrete or steel, like the more common engineering materials. And if you have a master's in those fields, that doesn't rule you out. In fact, lots of times just having a master's degree in any field or any topic is useful, because it's like refining those problem solving skills, trying to take like a large complex problem and turning it into something approachable with steps. And that's, I think, is very useful in any engineering field, but especially in the facade industry, where we have like a large complex building that we're breaking down into step-by-step parts. So you definitely don't need a master's degree. It doesn't even need to be necessarily in facades, but there is some useful skills gained in that problem-solving process that you learn in grad school.
Yeah, almost this idea of like learn how to learn what you don't know. Like, what is the process to be in a situation of I don't know this to, well, I've got my best guess at an answer.
Yeah, exactly.
So, James, where do you you've been working there for 5 years? You've got the structural engineer one. You already have your master's degree. What does the future look like for you in that role? How far can you go, kind of in the technical field for what you're doing?
Sure. So, as a PE, so currently I'm serving as a PE on one project. The next steps would primarily be, at least at our firm, is where you become a PE over multiple jobs at one time. So I would kind of relinquish some of the day-to-day activities as the lead engineer to a younger engineer, to someone who I'm like kind of supervising, and I become more of a overall project direction role, where I'm kind of helping guide the big picture design of a facade. I still would be doing all the reviewing of the calculations and all the reviewing of the drawings, but I wouldn't be necessarily performing on a daily basis all those calculations. Instead, it'd be like sitting more in design, general concept and design meetings, working more one-on-one with the designers in terms of setting the overall scope of the project and managing multiple projects at one time.
Okay. Where does the line between technical work and management work in terms of a traditional manager? Is that strictly from the professional engineer, or is there also kind of a sub route of management that oversees the technical employees in certain ways?
Yeah. So in terms of my firm, which I can kind of only speak to that context, technically, like the kind of the management structure from a technical standpoint always runs through, like a junior would report to a lead and a lead would report to the professional engineer. But then additionally, we have a department head who is a PE who is responsible for their own projects, but kind of sets the standard for the department. For the way that we're specifically structured as a structural engineering department within Permis Lisa, is that department head kind of meets with all the PEs on a bi-monthly basis to talk about general department direction. So even though he is responsible for our performance evaluations and more like doing the HR responsibilities of a manager, in terms of the technical aspect, he's kind of working with all the PEs at one time to say, where do we want to be? What design considerations do we want to decide or agree upon to kind of shape the future of our work? But we do have a department manager, which is a possible career step as well of the engineering department.
Okay. Do you see a lot of people kind of transition between those roles, between a technical and a managerial, then maybe even back to a technical role?
Definitely. I've seen the manager of our department change at least twice since I started. And so it's very possible like someone fulfills those duties and then no longer either wishes to do it or there's someone who's better suited. Additionally, a lot of our structural engineers will become managers. They'll become like project managers, right? Or project design manager. So instead of only working on just the structural aspect of a project, they'll move on and then oversee the entire design team. So that's the thermal side of the facade, the drafting, air water design side of the facade, and the modeling side. So we do everything we design and build gets built in the computer. We develop these 3D models. And so all of that kind of falls under the design aspect of our company. So there's like a product design manager that several engineers have gone from the structural side into that role with the project and also become project managers. So you end up moving to site and kind of being like the site superintendent, supervising the construction, but also kind of working with the schedule and the budget as well. So you would leave the technical aspect of structural engineering, but you would still be involved with the facade.
Okay.
One of the other questions I had, James, is just kind of like rough salary things. I really just kind of wondering for like the entry junior level engineer. Can you give me like what's the broad range? I know everyone listening, obviously when you think about salaries, there's many, many things to think about. I mean, there's the true salary, which includes benefit things and cost of living locally and a lot of other things to consider. But I do think it's helpful for the listeners to be able to get a rough idea of where an entry-level job as a junior engineer in this case would sit. Do you have any idea what that range would be?
Yeah, so it's somewhere between $55,000 and $65,000 for a junior entry-level, structural engineer.
Gotcha.
And that might be slightly outdated. You know, it's been a while since I was in that role, but.
Yeah. Do you think, sure. Does having a master's degree in that area, does that help with the initial starting salary if you come in as a junior with a master's degree versus just with a bachelor's?
Yeah, it definitely could, especially if that master's degree is relevant to facades and high-rise structures. Yeah.
Okay.
It could.
Well, I think coming towards kind of the last few questions I had, or really the last question, it's mostly related to, you know, you think of younger James, I guess second year, sitting in the library or whatever, working on his problems for statics. If you could go back in time and talk to that James, what would you tell him about, I guess anything. What advice would you give him? What would you want to say to him?
Yeah, I think I was very much in school. I was focused on solving the problem at hand and like learning the engineering equations that I needed to know how to use to solve an exam problem or a homework problem. And I wish I would have instead focused more on the general concepts behind the equations, right? So really understanding what ductility means and kind of understanding how the material behaves under that, and understanding brittleness and trying to maybe like really understand those core fundamental engineering topics instead of just what equation do I use and how do I apply it? Because those equations are available to us at any time. I can open up a code and find the equation I need to use at any time of the day. But what I can't necessarily do is always figure out how exactly to apply this engineering knowledge without truly understanding material behavior. So that would be one, is focusing kind of on more material behavior and the reasoning why the engineering equations are the way that they're set up, and asking more of those questions. Two would be, I think a lot of what we do, a lot of what I experience too, is that the equations in the codes, whether that's the steel code or the concrete code, are written with a specific set of assumptions on how they are built. And lots of times when I'm dealing with glass or aluminum or different materials, those assumptions aren't valid, right? So I can't just necessarily take a general engineering equation and apply it in this instance because it might not be applicable. So instead, if I can understand what's happening, what my loads are, how is that load imposing on the element I'm checking, I can then understand how to approach it, right? So it might not be exactly what the code says I need to do, but I'm applying the fundamental knowledge or the main concept of the code that's specific to this case. So it's like interpreting the meaning of the code, the reasoning why the code is written and the language it's using, and then applying the meaning to my specific problem. I hope that makes sense in how I've described it.
Yeah. And to be clear, by code, you're not talking about like the code you're going to enter into an FEA solver. You're talking about like the book of code of how you build with cement.
Yeah, correct. So this is the American Concrete Institute Guide for Designing for Reinforced Concrete.
Wait, sorry. I said cement. I'm sorry. Am I not supposed to say cement?
Yeah, you're wrong on that one. That's okay. It's definitely concrete. Cement is an element, is the bonding agent in concrete.
Okay. I'm sorry. But don't be offended, James.
Or the steel code or the aluminum design manual, which dictates how to design with aluminum, or the glass design, different packages that are out there from Ghana and different agencies. So,
yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, I think if we extrapolate our jobs into the engineer from 10 years from now, meaning like, let's say you're just starting undergrad now, like it's only going to push more into these equations being solved by computer. And so if you're just responsible for plugging the numbers and saying, hit go, like it really becomes your fundamental understanding to gut check the software out, you know, whatever the output is. And if you don't have a basic understanding of ductility or these other important fundamentals, it's going to be a real challenge to say, well, that number that's coming out, wave your thumb, seems right.
Yeah, exactly. I think lots of times as a junior engineer, I would get caught in the mindset of like, just solve the problem. Like, I'm here just to solve the problem. So it's really easy to run to a computer software, throw your numbers, your loads in, your material properties in, and get a result out without thinking through, does this make sense? Right? Is the way that the stress is distributing, does that make sense with how I'm expecting it to? And I think we like trying to have a better, bigger picture understanding of the engineering process and how the material behaves than just like plug and chug on equations or with software.
So James, how has your approach to technical problems changed as you've been working?
So another important aspect that I felt that I kind of learned and grew into through my first couple of years as an engineer is the idea of simplifying a problem. I think in school, lots of times we're just given a problem and you just kind of put your head down and solve it. And what I've kind of learned, I think, through the engineering process and applying the engineering process is that if I can take a problem and I can kind of lay out a roadmap or a path on how I want to approach this problem and solve it. And the more I can take a problem and simplify it down into easy, constructible steps that I know I can proceed through, I can turn a problem that maybe would have taken 16 hours if I just would have put my head down into something that maybe takes 8 to solve. And so I think as an engineer, and I didn't learn this in school, I definitely learned this on the job of like maybe being thorough and thinking through a problem before I just dive in. Like, how do I want to solve this? What tools do I need to solve this problem? And how can I simplify this problem down into things that I am familiar with and I'm comfortable with and that I'm confident that I understand the engineering approach to solving it? It's a really helpful tool, and I think in being a more productive engineer and a more confident engineer.
Yeah, that's great, James.
So I think another thing that was a kind of a difficulty or struggle for me in my first 2 years of engineering was the times to be detail-oriented versus the times to use a broad brush to solve a problem. So I think in engineering education, we get kind of bogged down in like, here's my one specific case, my one specific problem that I'm solving for. But in lots of times, as an example in curtain wall, is I will have my wind loads are not consistent across a building, right? It varies. The higher you get generally, the higher the wind loads get. In a corner where you have sharp edges, you get peak wind loads where you see maybe 2 times the amount of load there. It's really easy as an engineer to sometimes to get so detail focused of like, I've got 2,000 anchors and I'm going to design these 2,000 anchor points individually, one by one until I have them all solved. Instead of maybe taking a step back, using a broad brush and say, I'm going to solve 90% of these with one embed type or one anchor type. And then I'm going to go to this unique case over here that's by itself and solve for that. And so it's like, I'm going to paint a broad brush to solve 80% of these problems. And then I'm going to be detail-oriented over in this one unique condition because it requires it. And understanding through probably experience, right? But being okay using the broad brush approach. And then instead of just getting so focused on detail-oriented, there's times you need to be, but it's expensive to be detail-oriented, both in terms of the resources and the time it takes. So the more we can use a broad brush approach, I think it generally helps. In terms of the facade design, it definitely helps.
I think that makes a lot of sense in terms of stepping back and looking at the whole picture. I think it's easy to get to dive down into the details and, you know, bring your head up, you know, hours, days, weeks later and realize that you could have either done it differently or you've totally like missed the problem in some ways. And this sounds like one of those situations where it's like, maybe we should just think about maybe before we dive in, like we want to solve the problem. Let's take some time to look at the philosophy, what we're trying to do, and then break it down into smaller chunks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's a really good way to put it.
Sweet, guys. That's really helpful. James, there's a lot of your job that I didn't really quite understand, but it sounds like you really enjoy it, man, which is the best part. I mean, really, it sounds like you wake up and enjoy going to work.
Yeah, I hope I explained it well in terms of what I actually do. I love my job. My job's great. I feel motivated. It's really challenging. I think a lot of times on a daily basis, I encounter problems, one that I've definitely never seen before, but even when I go to our senior PEs who have 15 plus years of experience, they've never seen it. So because it's like in the architectural field and architects are always pushing the boundaries, we get to encounter problems in the facade industry that are unique and different and new. And sometimes that's really frustrating because you don't always know how to approach it from an engineering standpoint. But it's really rewarding when you get to sit down and think through it and come up with a sound engineering solution. That challenge is, it gets you motivated to go to work every day.
That's awesome. I think that's a great place to end. We're just about come up on our time for this. So unless you have any other ending comment to end us with, James, it's been great having you on the show.
No, it's been a pleasure to be on. I think what you guys are doing here is really cool. I wish I would have had this resource when I was in school or as a young engineer.
All right. Thanks, James. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Engineer Your Career with Troy Bauman and Brennan Timrak. For more information about the show, visit our website at eycpodcast.com. There you can find show notes for each episode and get in touch with Troy and I. If you or someone you know are an engineer with an interesting or even not so interesting career journey and would like to be on the show, go on the website, send us a short bio, and we may just invite you to come on and share your story. And finally, if you want to show your support, please rate, review, like, or subscribe to the show on your podcast player of choice.